Residents of the southern Indian state of Kerala are trying to recover from the worst flood in a century, and members of Illinois' large Indian community are raising money to help. The response has been overwhelming. Here's Addison resident Abraham Matthew.
First day, we were able to raise around $6,000. Then I kind of told them that, oh, okay, I'm pretty sure the money, okay, that's about it. But surprisingly, second day, we were able to raise $80,000. So at that moment, we realized that this is going to be out of our control.
Plus, Albert Lee was an African-American man who started working at the University of Illinois' president's office in 1895. And over the next 52 years, he helped some of U of I's first black students succeed at a time when they were often denied access to resources like housing. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll hear the remarkable story of an African-American man who, starting in 1895, helped black students at the University of Illinois succeed and thrive at a time they weren't even allowed to live in the dorms. Keeping with our college theme, we'll also take a look at the millions of dollars in donations to college athletic facilities and the role big donors play in shaping the direction of college campuses. But first, people in the southern Indian state of Kerala are recovering from the worst flood in almost a century. Almost 400 people have been killed in this natural disaster that started 2 weeks ago. More than 1 million people have been displaced from their homes. Authorities in Kerala estimate the damage is more than $2.5 billion. Since the flood, members of Illinois' Indian community, which make up the largest portion of the state's Asian American population, have been raising money to help with relief efforts. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with one Chicago area man who's helped raise more than $1.5 million in a Facebook campaign. First, though, we're joined by Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, who represents Illinois' 8th District. That's many of the northern suburbs of Chicago. We caught up with him yesterday afternoon while he was in Schaumburg. Congressman, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla.
I'm sorry you're here to talk about these circumstances. I know this has been really devastating news. Can you tell us what you know about the situation?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I'm glad that you're shining a spotlight on this particular issue. As you mentioned, almost 400 people have died from the floods. 1 million people have been displaced. Billions of dollars in property damage have been incurred. And though the floodwaters appear to be receding, it's leaving devastation in its wake. And, you know, I think that the people of Kerala need a lot of help. And fortunately, there are a lot of people that are standing up to help them. And I'm pleased to have been a small part of a couple of these events that have taken place. And I know that more will happen.
I think that people in Illinois might be aware of our Indian population, mostly in the Chicago area, but there's a big part of our population, the significant part, that's South Indian population, including people from Kerala. I wondered if you think there are quite a few people in Illinois who are maybe personally affected by this.
Yes, I think so. You know, I think that there are a lot of people, in fact, in my own congressional district who are affected, and that is in part why, you know, there was an event in support of Kerala in my district in Schaumburg last night, and there was another event on Friday night not far from my district. And so I think there are a lot of people affected, and of course, I am seeing a lot of different communities, Indian American communities, kind of rally to the support of the Keralite community, and I think that's only appropriate because I think that the same has happened for other parts of the country as well in the past.
I think there are probably people who are listening whom this may be the first time that they've even heard of these floods happening. It's not something that's gotten a great deal of coverage, I think, particularly by many American news outlets. I wonder if that frustrates you.
You know, gosh, there's so much going on right now in the news. I can understand how different newsrooms are stretched beyond capacity as it is. That being said, it's always nice to hear about what's happening outside of the borders of the United States, and certainly what's happening with regard to natural disasters. And I think a lot of Americans would be very touched by the scenes that you see in Kerala where people are rescuing each other, coming to each other's aid. You know, these are the times when they're showing their true colors in terms of their courage and compassion toward one another as well.
And so you mentioned these fundraisers. How did they go?
I think they went well. I don't know what the final tallies were, but I think that this is probably the first of several fundraising efforts that will occur. As you mentioned before, there have been some fundraising efforts online, and I'm heartened to see that at least one of the people involved appears to be from my district, and so that's great. I think that there's going to be a lot of generosity directed toward Kerala.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Representative, I think most Americans may not be aware that the Indian government in recent times has not accepted foreign aid after both the tsunami and now the Indian government and Prime Minister Modi he's been really criticized for reportedly refusing a couple offers of foreign assistance for this disaster. As an American government official, I wonder if you have thoughts about this policy.
Well, I think that each government has the right to act on behalf of its people and to represent them as their people wish. At the same time, I think it's okay to receive logistical assistance, especially in areas where perhaps other nations or places have experience and maybe some expertise to offer. And so I hope that the Indian government is working with others, such as the American government and other non-governmental organizations, to kind of muster the maximum response. I think that in any case, people can individually donate to charities, can individually send money to their relatives and to non-governmental organizations in Kerala, and I think they'll continue to do so.
While I have you here, I wonder if I could just ask you about a couple events closer to us.
Sure.
Here in home for in Illinois. In particular, I wanted to just ask you about the news this weekend of Governor Rauner's veto of a law that would have established a minimum threshold for teachers in Illinois, a salary threshold of $40,000. Right now it's about $10,000. I wonder what kind of reaction you have to that.
Well, gosh, I don't think anybody can survive on $10,000 as a teacher. And, you know, what you see in a lot of other states is when you don't take care of teachers and public schools and public education, you see a whole host of problems. In fact, in a bunch of states recently, places like Oklahoma and West Virginia and other states that may not be, you know, as progressive as Illinois, those state legislatures had to enact large pay increases to basically make sure that the schools could function properly. You know, you can't have teachers, you know, drive Uber and then do their jobs and grade homework and prepare for the next day all at the same time. This doesn't make any sense. If we really care about the future, we need to take care of our children and we need to take care of their educators as well.
Congressman Krishnamurthy, I did want to ask you one other thing. I know you sit on the House Committee for Education, and sort of the flip side of this education story. The University of Illinois announced on Monday a new financial aid program that's designed to make enrollment at UIUC more affordable for middle-class students. And basically, if their family income is below $61,000 a year, they pledge to cover tuition and mandatory fees for students who are accepted at the university. I wonder how much you think we'll start to see more public universities make moves like this to make college education more affordable.
I think that's a good step in the right direction. I still think that the cost of college and four-year university is growing too quickly. And I think that a lot of people still feel that, you know, four-year universities and colleges are really out of reach. And because of that, you know, I think that a lot of people are pushing for even greater reforms in our colleges and universities to hold the line on tuition and room and board. And, you know, the federal government invests a lot of money in student aid and federal student aid. And I've said that, you know, we should make sure that we make access as affordable as possible. And I've voted to increase student aid, such as, for instance, making Pell Grants available year-round and so forth. However, if we're going to do that, then we have to make sure that colleges and universities, I've said this before, offer a Costco deal to the taxpayers. And we got to make sure that we hold the line on costs, devote as much money to academic purposes as possible, and make sure that whatever increases in aid that we give at the federal level don't go toward increases in tuition and then, you know, basically we're frittering away the tax dollars. The other thing I just want to mention very quickly, and I'm very glad what University of Illinois is doing, and I'm heartened by their leadership steps here. But one other thing I wanted to mention very quickly is that the other big story on Capitol Hill with regard to education is that G.T. Thompson and I, he's a Republican from Pennsylvania, and myself, we just got the reauthorization of Perkins Career Technical Education Programs signed into law 3 weeks ago. This is for the two-thirds of Americans who are not going to get a four-year college degree. Two-thirds of Americans are going to utilize the skills-based education system. Some people call it vocational education and so forth that our nation offers to folks at the high school and community college level. But it hasn't been modernized in 12 years. And so we finally got this done. And I think this is another excellent path for people to take into the middle class. And it's going to be debt-free for the most part. And so I hope that people explore all avenues, both four-year college and universities, but also, you know, going down the skills-based education path, because we need everybody ultimately to get into the middle class, and there are many paths there.
That's Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. He represents Illinois' 8th Congressional District, lots of the northern northwest suburbs of Chicago. Representative, thanks for being with me. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Nyla.
There are about a quarter of a million South Asian Americans in Illinois. Asian Indians make up the largest portion of that South Asian population, mostly in the Chicago area. So when news of the floods hit Illinois, two Chicago area Carolites decided to do something about it. Arun Simon of Arlington Heights set up a Facebook campaign. His goal was to raise $100,000. But within days, his campaign surpassed all expectations. And to date, more than $1.5 million have been raised. Arun has gone to India at the request of the state government of Kerala for his fundraising efforts. But another Keralite, Addison, Illinois resident Abraham Matthew, is the communications manager for the campaign, and he's on the line with us now. Hi, Abraham. Welcome to the 21st.
And aloha. Thank you.
And Abraham, I just wanted to make sure, how is your family doing?
Everyone's fine. Actually, my mom's side is in India. They live near a river, so they were actually affected, so they had to move. But they are okay now. They're in a safe place now.
Okay, good. That's good to hear. So when Arun decided to set this Facebook campaign up, I know he reached out to you. When he said, I want to raise $100,000, did you think that was too ambitious?
Well, actually, we all wanted to do something about it. So when he contacted me first, he kind of asked me, you know, what should we do? So I kind of told him, you know, we should actually contact some kind of Indian organizations here, because there's a bunch of them here. So then he actually contacted some organizations, and he told me that we did not really get a prompt reply back. So then he did not really think twice. He created this Facebook fundraiser. So then he told me the target is $100,000. So I was a little surprised, but, you know, I said, you know, let's give it a try and let's see, you know, how it goes.
And then what happened? When did it start getting passed around?
Well, actually, this was a surprise for us as well. The first day, we were able to raise around $6,000. So then I kind of told him that, oh, okay, I'm pretty sure the money, okay, that's about it. It'll probably go under $10,000. But surprisingly, second day, we were able to raise $80,000. So at that moment, we realized that this is going to be out of our control. So it was a total surprise for us.
Wow. So it raises $80,000 in 48 hours. How did you manage that? Is that at the point that you all reached out to Facebook and said, hey, we need some help with this?
Yeah. So the second day, Arun contacted me and asked me, hey, oh, now we're at $80,000. So at that moment, we realized that, okay, now we have to take some actions. So we contacted the Facebook corporate, and luckily they were really happy to help us. And they actually made a project team for us. So for the past 10 to 12 days, we've been working with them. And they actually gave us a lot of directions in terms of media and how the process should be. So we've been working with them for the past almost 2 weeks now. Yep.
And then you got a letter, the state government in Kerala heard about this. The chief minister in charge of all of the disaster relief reached out to you guys as well?
So towards the end of the first week, we were getting a lot of questions saying, "So this is a lot of money. So this is just this much amount of money is raised by a couple of guys." So a lot of questions. We were getting a lot of questions, and they were kind of asking, "Is this even real? Is this fake?" So we actually contacted a couple of. I was actually the in charge of communication. I was the director of communications. So we contacted the chief minister's office, and actually, luckily, they actually called us back, and they actually gave us some kind of letter saying that this is an approved, authorized charity event.
And so all of the money that you've raised is going directly to the state government in Kerala.
That is correct. There's a chief minister's distress relief fund, which is so initially we kind of made it clear that the whole money will be transparent. So based on our knowledge, chief minister's distress relief fund is most transparent in Kerala as of now.
Okay. And Abraham, you're an industrial engineer. This is not even like this is your full-time job. You're not an activist. What does it feel like to be a part of this process and know that you're raising so much money for the state that you grew up in?
Well, it's really interesting that none of us are any activists or anything like that. So, for the past 2 weeks, Arun and I've been going to bed like 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning. We've been really busy. I felt like if I was doing this job in my real work, I would be promoted by now. So the good thing is we don't even feel like we're tired, so it's a very really good feeling that, we're actually doing this for a good cause.
You're doing it for a really important cause. So I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. It's Addison, Illinois, Abraham Matthew on this Facebook fundraising campaign that's raised more than $1.5 million. You guys are still raising money, right, Abraham?
That is correct. As of today, we have crossed $1.6 million, and we're going to continue this for a couple more weeks or until it's pretty slow.
We will tweet out those links for those of you that are interested. Abraham, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Neela.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The first African American student at the University of Illinois enrolled in 1887. That's long before many other public universities in the U.S., especially in southern states. But that doesn't mean life was easy both back then and in the decades after. Black students weren't allowed to live in dorms and were often denied basic services in the towns of Champaign and Urbana. For many of these Black students, an African American man named Albert R. Lee was a lifeline. He started working at the University of Illinois in 1895. And for the next 50 years, he worked at the university, including as chief clerk of the U of I's president's office. During that time, he became known as the unofficial dean of African American students for the work that he did to advocate for Black students and connect them with resources they didn't have access to. As students gather for their first week of classes this week here at the University of Illinois, members of his family will also gather to commemorate his life. I'm joined now by one of Albert Lee's family members. David Lee is his great-grandson. He is a public health professional in L.A. He also works for Charles R. Drew University in L.A., where he oversees a public health program in South L.A. I also want to welcome Vanessa Ruyan. She's working on a biography and a documentary about Mr. Lee's life. She's an assistant professor of writing and rhetoric at James Madison University in Virginia. David, Vanessa, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Of course.
Vanessa, I wonder if we could start with the early days of Mr. Lee's career at the University of Illinois. He first started working in the president's office in 1895.
Yeah, he was hired, he was employed as to be messenger at the president's office. This is President Draper. He started as a messenger, but he made himself indispensable to the office. And in only a few years, he was made a clerk, mostly because he was addressing correspondence and he was this dignified and trusted figure mediating on behalf of African-American students. So he leveraged his own promotion very rightly so, I would say, by making the person notice that, well, if he's a messenger and it's the messenger signing particular letters, he needed a higher position, and that's how he started from clerk. And he, 52 years later, when he finally retired, he was the chief clerk and had been for several years.
And Vanessa, where did Mr. Lee, where was his where did he get his education? Did he grow up in Illinois?
He did. He was the son of a man who was made a slave in Kentucky, but Mr. Lee was born in the outskirts of Champaign on a farm. When he was a child, they moved to Champaign proper. So he graduated from Champaign High School, and he did 1 year, 1897 to 1898, of classes and general education, liberal arts at the university, but he didn't complete that. But he has always referred to himself as a self, he studied himself using the curriculum and the books that regular universities, regular students had to use.
Mm. David, I wonder what you knew of your great-grandfather growing up. I mean, certainly just his level of education, I would think in the late 1890s was remarkable.
Yes, I had heard the stories about Albert R. Lee when I was growing up from my father, who told me different stories about how he worked at the University of Illinois and how many of my other family members were able to go to school there as a result of Albert R. Lee. My other great grandfather, Forrest Anderson, who was a Black Oklahoma millionaire, sent his three daughters to the University of Illinois. And the story that was told to me was that Albert R. Lee helped my grandmother with her housing. It just so happened that Albert R. Lee had a young, handsome son living in the household. And so as a result, my grandfather had his bride put right under his nose, and that's how my grandparents came together.
Oh, so that's how your grandparents met. And your other great-grandfather, you said, was a millionaire in Oklahoma. This would have been in the early 1900s?
This was in the 1920s. He was an oil millionaire. And so he made sure that his three daughters got an education, and it was the University of Illinois that and the connection with Albert R. Lee that made that all possible.
Mm. And as David is talking, Vanessa, about how his grandmother received housing, what was that like? So Black students were allowed to be admitted to the university, but, for example, they weren't allowed to live in the dorms?
Right. Housing, I would say, was dire for everybody, but especially for African Americans. And this is where Mr. Lee comes in. He was the mediator between the school and African American families and Bethel families, so that students could have a place to live, and they would cross the railroad tracks and come to classes. Now, there were restaurants on campus, and it was illegal to deny service. However, there were extra legal measures, I guess, and service was typically delayed. So students had to do, African-American students had to do the extra effort of go back to their host families, have their meals there, come back and continue with his classes.
Mm. Vanessa, it's such a remarkable life that we're thinking about, Mr. Lee. Someone who, and I think it's an interesting story of, you know, for maybe African-American students legally were admitted to the University of Illinois, but then it sounds like there was obviously a lot of negotiation, a lot of difficulties in actually becoming students and being successful. How did you first hear about the story of Mr. Lee? How did you come across this?
Spring of 2009, and this was my second semester as a doctoral student at the Department of English, and I was taking a class, Race and Literacy, and we had to find evidence, archival pieces, primary texts, documenting the transition of African Americans on campus. I had found other pieces. I had heard about Mr. Lee's papers, but the Archivist for Life and Culture made me notice his papers. And it's just 1 cubic feet, 3 boxes. I started exploring those boxes, and I just couldn't let go from then on. Everything that had to do with finishing my courses, my doctoral courses, had to do with Lee, with his church, and with African-American rhetoric.
And so Bethel was the church, the AME church here in Champaign-Urbana. How important, what role did the church play in helping students as well?
Very. It was a crucial role. As I, if you go through the families that hosted African-American students, those are Bethel families. That was the church to go to. And it was Bethel families who accepted students, remodeled their houses as they could, and took them in. Bethel was also important because traditionally students form associations, and Mr. Lee directed one association for African-American students so that they could practice, so that they could do rhetorical exercises. So Bethel was the site to be, the place of dignity and safety even.
We're talking to Vanessa Rouillon, who's working on a biography and a documentary about the life of Albert R. Lee, the unofficial dean of African-American students at the University of Illinois. First started working at the U of I, as we're talking about, in 1895. His great-grandson, David Lee, is also with us on the line from L.A. Vanessa, how many students are we talking about? So when we think, I don't know what the population, the student population of the University of Illinois was like in the early 1900s or in the 1920s when David's grandparents met. How many Black students were there?
Not very many. Mr. Lee saw the school grow from 800 students to 18,000. But I don't have the figure with me right now, but I would say it was a small number. It was a small number of African American students.
Just sort of probably a handful of students, it sounds like, particularly in the early 1900s.
That's true. Mm-hmm. The visibility, they were not really that visible. There were not really very many, but they were there to advance their education.
And I wonder when as he started to become known as the unofficial dean of African-American students, Vanessa, I wonder, did this ever get him into any trouble, whether it's with university officials or maybe local residents who didn't want to see Black students being educated?
No, I don't think so. I think he was very cautious. I think he understood the times he was living in. He was at times, in my work, I see him as perhaps not critical enough of the university. I think he understood. His ideology was mostly one of let the races interact, and they'll find one another not so different. So he was careful. I believe he was always careful, and I haven't encountered anything that might have yielded a reaction against his work. Not at all.
Mm. David, I know that you and Vanessa and other but also other members of your family are going to be in Champaign-Urbana. What's going to be happening here later this week as you remember his life?
Well, there's going to be some activities, I believe, at the university and also at the cemetery where Albert R. Lee is buried. I think his grave has been unmarked most of this time until recently. There's going to be a headstone unveiling and then some activities at Bethel AME Church. It's mostly just going to be a celebration of the life of and legacy of Albert R. Lee. You know, and I have to say that I've learned a lot about my ancestor through Vanessa, who actually reached out to my family to be a part of these activities coming up. And, you know, we've all done a lot of family genealogy and historical work, but Vanessa basically did all the work for us as far as Albert R. Lee. So we're really appreciative of that.
Vanessa, yeah, thank you for sharing that, David. Vanessa, so Mr. Lee passed away in 1948. Is the university now maybe in a place where it's much more recognizing of the role that he played, and particularly the historical nature of the role that he played? I mean, certainly as we look back on people this year, I'm thinking even of the New York Times starting to run obituaries of prominent voices of people who passed mm-hmm. away who were not recognized. Is it something similar to that, you think, what the university is doing now for Mr. Lee?
Yeah, I agree. I think it took me, I graduated 5 years ago, and it took me sort of 5 years to reach to the right people. But as we did and we started planning for all of these memorial events, I see a commitment. I see goodwill in the university in actually remembering him and paying tribute to his work. It seems to me we tend to think that civil rights is just the 60s, and Mr. Lee did a lot of the work in those first, when he was alive, in those first 50 years of the 20th. He didn't have a headstone. We do have one now. He might have had one, but it's not clear. Vandalism in the 60s might be the result, but we have a nice headstone. It's on place. That's the one we'll unveil on Friday. There will be recognitions from the chancellor. The family will be greeted by the president to see a plaque in the president's suite. So we are, for years, his markers have been these three archival boxes. But now we'll have one marker at the cemetery, one marker at the president's office, another plaque in Bethel, and...
really remembering his history, Vanessa. Yeah. David, why do you think I wanted to ask David, why is it important for you that your great-grandfather's story isn't just preserved for your family, but shared widely with members of the public in the university community here?
Well, this is an example of an important historical figure who happened to be African-American. And, you know, up until this time, this story has never been really told. And so I think it's really important so we don't lose these stories of important African Americans. You know, it also changed the trajectory of my life in different ways, in the fact that, you know, I had a great-grandfather who really valued education and made sure that my grandfather got in education. My grandfather had a bachelor's degree from the University of Illinois. Then my father had a bachelor's degree from the University of Illinois. And so, you know, as a result, you know, education was stressed in my family, and I also have advanced degrees. And so that's how Albert R. Lee impacted my life. And I think that these stories need to be preserved and told so they don't get lost.
Well, thank you both for sharing these stories so our audience throughout the state and outside of the Champaign-Urbana area can hear the story of Albert R. Lee. I want to thank Vanessa Rouillon for being with us and bringing us the story. She's a biographer and working on a documentary about Mr. Lee's life. David Lee is Albert R. Lee's great grandson, also working in a university. He's the director of a public health program in South LA at Charles R. Drew University. Both of you, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Are you an organ donor? More than 60% of people living in Illinois are, but just until a few months ago, you could only sign up if you were 18 and older. But under a new law that took effect this year, teenagers, 16 and 17-year-olds, can choose to donate their organs through Illinois' database. Illinois now joins the vast majority of other states in doing this. We had been one of three that hadn't allowed teenagers to join the organ donor list. And now that it's allowed, since January, more than 16,000 teenagers have added their names to the list. So how is this affecting people who are awaiting organ transplants? We're going to find out about that now with Kevin Smut. He's president of the Gift of Hope Organ and Tissue Donor Network. He's on the line from Itasca, a suburb northwest of Chicago. Jacob Lenzini is also with us. He's a 17-year-old from Park Ridge, which is just northwest of Chicago as well. Kevin, Jacob, welcome to the 21st. Thanks, both of you, for being here with me.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Jacob, I wonder if you can start by sharing with us your family story of how you got involved with this. This happened before this. You started getting involved with this a couple years ago before you were 17.
Yeah. So about just over three years ago, my dad passed away suddenly from a brain tumor that none of us knew about. It was really sudden, and he was in the hospital, and he died, which was obviously very, very hard on my family. That's how we got introduced to the Gift of Hope, and the name really is fitting. The Gift of Hope is Kevin Smut is the CEO of the primary organ tissue and just transplant, and we got connected to them through my dad's gift, and it really is a gift of hope because with death there's complete and total loss, but this really gave something back to my family as well as the people who received my dad's organs.
Yeah, I'm so sorry for your loss. It sounds like for you all and for your family, though, you were able to see how your dad's organs were able to help other people and give them life?
Right, right. And that's something that a lot of people don't realize, that it's beneficial to the people who receive the organs because it saves their lives, but it's also beneficial to the people who lost a loved one because it really is a great thing for us to see.
And Jacob, it sounds like in a way it's been a way to keep your father's memory alive for you all too.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And it's what he wanted. It's what he would have continued to want as well. It really is a testament to the person that he was. And I think it's a great thing to do, and to show just how caring and thoughtful you are as a person. It really is a great thing to do. It's literally potentially could save somebody's life, So
yeah, Jacob, what did it mean to you when the law took effect in January that 16 and 17-year-olds could choose to add themselves to the database, to the registry?
Yeah, it was awesome, and it showed, it made me very happy because, more people's lives will be saved, and the quality of life of people for all around will, improve as well. And it's awful when a tragedy like that happens, and to think about, a 16 or 17-year-old dying, but it does happen sometimes. For there to be some kind of light at the end of the tunnel helps us all. So it really meant a lot to me to see that, people were improving as well, progressing and coming and just helping. It's really incredible seeing
the amount of people who have signed up too, right, Jacob? And
right.
Kevin, I wanted to ask you about that. It sounds remarkable that 16,000 young people have signed up since January. How did the word get spread for having 16 and 17-year-olds adding their name to the Organ and Tissue Donor Network?
Yeah, so we work closely with the Secretary of State. Jesse White's been a very strong supporter of organ and tissue donation for years. And so the secretary plays a major role in educating his staff at the driver's license facilities to offer this option to 16 and 17 year olds as they come in for their first driver's license. We're also working with high schools, the Illinois High School Athletic Association. We've got a program through several companies that offer driving instruction to young people to educate about organ and tissue donation so that our 16 and 17 year olds can make an informed decision when the opportunity to register is put in front of them.
And how many people are registered as donors in Illinois, Kevin?
So a little over 6 million people are registered to be organ and tissue donors in Illinois. That's about 55 or 60% of the people eligible. And it really is, it's important because, you know, Jacob's story is typical. You know, families are faced with a sudden loss of the most important person in their lives. And organ donors are like Jacob's dad. They're not supposed to be dead. They're sudden, they're catastrophic, and families are in an incredible emotional state, and they're thrown a lot of information and asked to make decisions. One of those is about donating organs and tissues, and having someone in the registry just helps facilitate that discussion. Knowing that your loved one thought about it and wanted to be an organ and tissue donor makes that decision so much easier on a family. And I really, at times I think I'm just keeping my seat warm for Jacob because he's going to take my job pretty soon. But I think what he said about the impact on donor families is absolutely critical. It's really miraculous, the power of donation and its ability to help families cope and heal with the tragic loss of a loved one. So we really encourage people to think about it and register if they can.
We're speaking with Kevin Smunt. He's president and CEO of the Gift of Hope Organ and Tissue Donor Network. Jacob Lenzini is also on the line with us. Both of them from the Chicago area. We're talking about this issue of organ and tissue donation. Kevin, so there's about 6 million people you said on the list. How many people are waiting for, or how many people are hoping to get organs or needing organs?
Yeah, so there's about 120,000 people nationwide waiting for an organ transplant. Last year, as a nation, we transplanted about 35,000 organs. So there's certainly a greater need than we have the ability to cover at this point. In Illinois, it's about 4,000 people on the wait list. So yeah, we're always in need of additional donations. And although we're very pleased, we've seen about a 60% increase in organ donation in Illinois in the last 5 years. There's still lots of work to do, and we know that we can do even better.
And when you talk about the lots of work to do, I wonder, Kevin, how much you think, are there still stigmas when it comes to organ donation?
Yeah, I think there are. Again, you know, when you think about this situation, every one of these cases is a tragic loss, and you're often faced with a family that's unfamiliar with a hospital setting. Maybe English isn't their first language, so they're in a very uncomfortable position to begin with amongst strangers. They're faced with the loss of the most important person in their lives, and to thrust them into the discussion immediately after they found out that their loved one is brain dead to make a decision about organ donation is extremely difficult. And there's all kinds of questions about, what is the definition of brain death, and how do I know that my loved one has suffered an irretrievable loss of brain function? And I think, you know, the more education we have of the general public, and particularly our hospital partners, the better opportunity we have to offer donation in a setting that's conducive to a good decision.
And do you think there are some myths that still persist around this, or the other education pieces that you think people need to know around this issue, Kevin?
Yeah, I think, you know, probably the single largest is that, you know, if I sign up in the registry, hospitals won't make every effort to save me. And that really couldn't be further from the truth. You know, organ donation, in order to be an organ donor, we have to have heart beating and organs functioning. And so extraordinary measures have to be taken for people who suffered a catastrophic injury in order to make sure that organ donation can happen. And the determination that a person is not going to survive their injuries doesn't happen instantaneously. It takes, you know, days oftentimes where testing is done and you know, decisions can be made. So, you know, really extraordinary life-saving measures are taken in all of these cases. So that's probably the number one myth that we try to dispel.
Jacob, what do you say to folks who, obviously, other than sharing your family story, which is a very powerful one, what kind of things have you said to people who might be hesitant to sign up?
That are hesitant to sign up? Well, I tell them my story, and I attempt to convey to them, you know, how necessary of a thing this is and how life-changing of a thing this is. Not so much for the person that, you know, signs up when they get their license, but the person who may be in, you know, who knows when you pass away, that can receive and have their life changed from your organs. I mean, I met the man with my father's heart, and I met the man with my father's lungs, and they got their lives back. And that's something that my dad didn't have a chance to. There was no coming back from the tumor in his head. And these people were able to come back from the brink of death. And now they continue to live life to its fullest. They have families and grandchildren. And now they don't have to sit idly by on the couch, basically disabled from their, you know, from their conditions. They're able to go out and live their lives. And it's a beautiful thing to see. And, you know, if you... It's the simplest thing to do. You just sign up. You sign up, and you can save somebody's life. You know, you can give them that. You can give them their life back. So, I really call on everybody to just go online, take the 10 minutes, and sign up, because it's that easy.
And Kevin, to Jacob's point, what if for people who are looking for more information, where can they go?
Sure. You can go to our website, which is giftofhope.org, giftofhope.org. There's a button on there that you can click on to register. So I want to be a donor. It probably takes a minute. All you need is your driver's license in your hand. And there's information on our website about donation and statistics and all kinds of things. I guess, you know, I'd really emphasize, you know, if you just ask the general public the question of, when you die, would you like your organs to be used to save someone's life? About 90% of people will say, yes, I'd like to donate my organs. We only get 70% of families to say yes to donation. And I think it's primarily because they just don't know what their loved one wanted. That's why registration is so important. You leave that gift to your family to let them know what your wishes are, so that they're not forced trying to make that decision. You've already made it for them. And so we really encourage people to take a minute or two, go online at giftofhope.org and register to be an organ and tissue donor.
And Kevin, do we have a sense of how many people are in Illinois die each year waiting for an organ transplant?
There's about 300 that die on the wait list every year. And it's a difficult number to determine because some people get taken off the wait list when they're too sick to be transplanted anymore. But, you know, every organ that we recover is really literally saving a life.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing all of that information with us. Jacob, thank you for sharing your story and your family's story. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website. 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.